Okay, so let's dive into a case that really shook up the world of college sports. It all started back in 1991 at Brown University. Imagine you're on the women's gymnastics team, or the volleyball team.
Oh, yeah.
And suddenly, the university decides to cut your program, citing budget issues as the reason. Seems kind of unfair, right?
Yeah, it does. And that's exactly what sparked the landmark case of Cohen v. Brown University. This case really gets to the heart of Title IX.
Which, for our listeners who might not be as familiar, is a law that prevents sex discrimination in education.
Right. And it has huge E implications for college athletics. We're talking about ensuring equal opportunities for men and women to play sports at the college level.
So it's not just about who gets to be on the team, but also scholarships, facilities, even coaching and equipment.
It's about creating a truly level playing field in every sense of the word. And that's where Brown University, well, they kind of messed up.
Yeah, they did. So back in 1991, Brown was facing those tough budget choices that so many universities deal with, and they made the decision to demote four varsity teams to donor-funded status, essentially stripping them of that varsity status.
And two of those teams were women's gymnastics and volleyball. The thing is, Brown's student body was almost perfectly split between men and women at the time.
48% women, to be exact.
Yet only 37% of their varsity athletes were women.
So already we're seeing this gap.
A significant gap. And demoting those two women's teams just made it worse. It was this disparity that led Amy Cohen, a gymnast at Brown, and other female athletes to file a class action lawsuit.
This is where the case really gets going.
They argued that Brown's actions violated Title IX.
That they were further disadvantaging women in their athletic program.
Exactly. It wasn't just about those specific teams being cut. It was about a broader pattern of inequality. Their claim was that Brown was systematically failing to provide equitable opportunities for women's athletics.
And this case didn't just end there, right? It had a long journey through the courts.
Oh, yeah. A real roller coaster ride. First, they went to the district court in 1992. The female athletes actually won that round. The court issued a preliminary injunction ordering Brown to reinstate the women's gymnastics and volleyball teams.
So a whim for the athletes.
Mm.
But I'm guessing Brown didn't just accept that.
Of course not. They appealed the decision. So the case then went up to the First Circuit Court of Appeals in 1993.
And what happened there?
The appeals court upheld the lower court's decision. And importantly, they affirmed the framework the lower court had used to determine if Brown had actually violated Title IX. This framework is known as the three-prong test, and it's super important.
It became central to this case and really to all of Title IX compliance when it comes to college athletics.
Absolutely. It's like the gold standard.
So break it down for us. What are these three prongs? What do they actually look at?
All right. So the first prong is what's called substantial proportionality.
And this is where that gap we talked about earlier, the difference between the percentage of female students and female athletes, really comes into play, right?
You got it. It basically means that the proportion of athletic opportunities for men and women at a school should more or less mirror the overall gender breakdown of the student body.
So if half your students are women, you should aim to have roughly half of your athletic opportunities allocated to women.
Exactly. And that's where Brown fell short. Remember that 11% gap between female students and female athletes?
Yeah, not looking good for Brown.
That was a big red flag when it came to substantial proportionality.
But some people might say, well, Brown was in a tough financial spot. Couldn't they justify these cuts based on their budget? Where do we draw the line between, like, budget realities and their legal obligations?
That's a great question, and it's something we'll definitely dig into more later on.
Okay, good, because I'm curious about that.
But focusing on this first prong, it was clear that Brown just did not meet the standard of substantial proportionality. That gap was too big to ignore.
All right, so it's one prong, down two to go. What else do schools have to demonstrate to be in compliance with Title IX?
So the second prong focuses on the history of expansion. It asks, has the school been actively working to expand opportunities for women's athletics? Think about it. Are they adding women's sports or increasing opportunities for female athletes in existing programs?
So given they were cutting teams, I'm guessing Brown didn't do so well on this one either.
You're right on the money. They actually failed this prong pretty badly. Instead of expanding opportunities for women, they were actively reducing them.
Okay, so two strikes against Brown. What about the final prong of the test?
This one is all about accommodation of interests. It looks at whether the school's existing programs actually meet the needs and abilities of female students who want to play sports.
So basically, are there women who are interested and qualified to participate but just don't have the opportunity?
Exactly. And the court found that in Brown's case, there was indeed unmet demand for women's sports, especially after they demoted volleyball and gymnastics. Those programs just weren't the same after losing their varsity status.
So Brown struck out on all three prongs of this Title IX test. That seems pretty damning.
Yeah, it's not a good look. Now, it is important to remember that a school only needs to satisfy one of the three prongs to be considered in compliance. But the fact that Brown failed all three made their violation pretty clear-cut.
And this is why this case became such a landmark decision. It really cemented the three-prong test as the standard for determining whether a school is offering equal athletic opportunities.
Right. Cohen v. Brown set the bar.
But this is just the beginning of the story. In 1995, after a full trial, Brown was found liable for violating Title IX, and the court ordered them to come up with a plan to fix it, a plan to actually get into compliance.
It wasn't over yet.
I'm sure Brown wasn't too happy about that. Did they try to fight back against the ruling?
Absolutely. But remember, the appeals court had already weighed in and upheld the lower court's decision. And importantly, they upheld that three-part test. And this is where we get into this concept called the law of the case doctrine.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, so basically it means that once a higher court makes a ruling, the lower courts are bound by that decision, even if they don't completely agree with it. So the district court basically said, look, the appeals court has already spoken, and we have to follow their lead.
No getting around it.
Nope. And this really solidified the three-part test as the rule of the game for this case.
So Brown was stuck with the three-prong test, and they were told to figure out a way to get into compliance. But did they actually succeed?
Well, let's just say their initial attempts didn't quite hit the mark. The court even had to order them to elevate certain women's teams to varsity status.
Wow. So even after being found liable, they weren't making the changes the court wanted.
You got it. But then Brown appealed again. And this is where the story takes another turn. Instead of arguing about whether they violated Title IX, which was already settled, they decided to focus on the specific remedies imposed by the court.
Okay, so even though they were found liable, they were still pushing back against how to actually fix the problem.
Exactly. And this gets at a really important distinction in legal cases, the difference between liability and remedy. Liability means the court found you did something wrong, a violation. But remedy refers to the specific actions you have to take to fix that violation. Brown was basically saying, okay, maybe we messed up, but we don't think these remedies are the right way to go.
So the appeals court had to step in again.
Total.
And they basically said, look, Brown, you definitely violated Title IX. That's clear. But maybe the lower court was a bit too harsh in dictating exactly what you have to do to fix it.
You nailed it. They wanted a more collaborative approach, something that might involve the university, the athletes, maybe even some Title IX experts, to find a solution that truly addressed the inequalities without being too prescriptive.
So instead of just saying, do this, this, and this, they encouraged a more nuanced and flexible approach.
Exactly. It's almost like the court recognized that achieving real gender equity in athletics isn't just about checking boxes or following a rigid set of rules. It's about fostering a genuine commitment to creating a fair and inclusive environment for all athletes, a real culture shift.
And that's something that goes beyond just the legal requirement.
Absolutely. It's about changing attitudes and practices at every level.
This is where it gets really interesting, right? Because we've been talking about this case in a historical context back in the 1990s, but it has implications that reach far beyond Brown University and far beyond that specific time period.
Cohen v. Brown wasn't just about a few athletic teams at one university. It set a precedent that continues to shape how Title IX is interpreted and enforced all across the country. It's a case that's still relevant today.
So, what can we learn from this case all these years later? What's the big takeaway for anyone who cares about gender equality in sports, especially at the college level?
I think there are a few key lessons here. First, proportionality matters a lot. Even though the three-prong test offers some flexibility, the court really zeroed in on that gap between female students and female athletes. They basically said matching those percentages is crucial. Schools can't just ignore that. They have a real obligation to ensure their athletic programs reflect the makeup of their student body.
It seems like a pretty basic measure of whether a school is even trying to provide equal opportunities.
Right. It's like a starting point. Second, being proactive is super important. Schools can't just sit around and wait for a lawsuit to be filed. They need to actively monitor their athletic programs, pay attention to those participation rates, and address any disparities they see. And they need to do it before those disparities become major problems.
It's like preventative medicine for Title IX compliance. Catching those issues early on.
Exactly. It's much easier to make those small adjustments along the way than to try and overhaul a whole system later on. And finally, and this is a big one, budget constraints are not an excuse.
We touched on this earlier, but it's worth repeating because it seems like schools try to use this argument a lot.
All the time. Look, financial challenges are real, no doubt about it. But the law doesn't just disappear when times get tough. The obligation to provide equal opportunities under Title IX remains, regardless of a school's financial situation.
So Brown tried to pull the "we're broke" card, and the court basically said, "Nice try, but no."
Pretty much. They emphasize that if a school has to make cuts, those cuts cannot disproportionately impact women. That's a big no-no. And in Brown's case, choosing to cut women's teams when there was already that significant participation gap, well, that was a pretty blatant violation of Title IX.
I'm noticing a theme here. The court in this case wasn't just looking at the letter of the law, but the spirit of it as well. They really wanted to make sure that Title IX was being upheld in a meaningful way.
Exactly. And they were really focused on the public interest in enforcing Title IX. They reminded everyone that when Congress passed this law, their intention was very clear: to eliminate sex discrimination in education. And that includes athletics.
So Congress wanted a level playing field. And the court in Cohen v. Brown really reinforced that intent. They basically said, this is important and we're going to hold schools accountable.
It was a powerful message. Ensuring equal opportunities for women in athletics isn't just some nice idea. It's a fundamental part of upholding the law.
So where does all of this leave us? What does Cohen v. Brown mean for college athletes today, decades after this case was decided?
It really put schools on notice. They can't just brush these issues under the rug anymore. Cohen v. Brown created a roadmap for athletes who feel like their rights are being violated, a way to fight back.
It's like a legal playbook for gender equality in college sports.
And that's why this case is still so relevant today. It's a reminder that the battle for equality is ongoing. It's not over. And the law can be a really powerful tool for driving real, lasting change.
That's inspiring. We've covered a lot of ground so far in this deep dive. We've talked about Title IX, the three-prong test, the budget defense, even this concept of competitive opportunities.
Yeah.
But there's one more layer to this case, something we haven't really touched on yet.
And trust me, it's a big one. It will really make you think about this case in a whole new light.
Okay, now you've got me hooked. Listeners, stay tuned for the next part of our deep dive into Cohen v. Brown. We'll be back soon. All right, so we left off with Brown trying to appeal the remedies that the court imposed to fix those Title IX violations.
Yeah, and that's where things get even more interesting, I think, because the appeals court, well, they sent the case back to the lower court to reconsider those remedies.
Okay.
But they offered some pretty significant guidance along the way.
What kind of guidance? What were they telling the lower court to think about?
So they were kind of critical of the lower court for focusing a little too narrowly on what are called competitive opportunities when they were putting together those initial remedies.
Competitive opportunities. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I totally get what that means in the context of Title IX. Can you break that down for us?
Sure thing. So competitive opportunities is actually a really crucial but sometimes overlooked part of Title IX compliance when it comes to athletics. Basically, it means that men and women should have comparable opportunities to actually compete at a similar level.
So it's about more than just having the same number of teams or the same number of roster spots for men and women.
Exactly. It goes deeper than that. It's about the quality of the experience for those athletes, the level of competition they're facing, the quality of the facilities and equipment, the coaching they're receiving.
Even things like scheduling and travel arrangements.
All of that. It's about making sure those opportunities are truly comparable. And the appeals court felt like the district court hadn't really fully considered this when they were crafting that initial remedy.
So it's kind of like saying, okay, you might have the same number of players on the men's and women's teams, but are they actually playing on a level playing field? Are the opportunities really the same?
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. And that really gets to the heart of Title IX, right? It's about genuine equality of opportunity, not just some kind of superficial matching of numbers.
Okay, so that makes sense. But what did the appeals court want the district court to actually DO differently? How are they supposed to approach those remedies?
They basically said to the lower court, hey, you need to broaden your perspective a bit. Don't just get fixated on the number of athletes. You need to think about the overall quality of the athletic experience for women and how competitive those opportunities actually are.
So are they saying that Brown had to make its women's athletic programs like just as prestigious and well-funded as the men's programs?
Not necessarily identical, but definitely comparable in terms of the opportunities they offer. It's about ensuring women have a real shot at developing their skills and competing at a high level, maybe even going pro if that's their goal.
So this begs the question. Did Brown actually manage to come up with a remedy that satisfied the court, the athletes, everyone involved?
Well, that's the thing. This case went on for years. Lots of back and forth, negotiations, more legal battles. It was a long road. Cohen v. Brown was a huge step forward in terms of Title IX, but it didn't just magically solve every problem overnight.
Yeah, it sounds like these issues are really complicated, and there's not always a clear-cut answer.
You're absolutely right, but even though the case itself eventually concluded, it really had a lasting impact. It changed the way schools think about Title IX compliance, and it empowered athletes to really advocate for their rights.
So we've talked about the three-pronged test and this whole idea of competitive opportunities, but let's go back to something we touched on earlier, Brown's argument that budget constraints forced them to make these cuts in the first place. What happened with that line of reasoning? Did the court buy it?
So Brown definitely tried to use their financial situation as justification for these cuts. They said, look, we had to make some tough choices. Athletics was on the chopping block.
It sounds like they were saying, hey, Title IX is important, but we're broke. We had to do what we had to do.
Yeah, essentially. But the court wasn't having it. They were very clear that budget constraints cannot be used as an excuse to justify discrimination. Title IX doesn't just disappear when things get tight financially. The responsibility to provide equitable opportunities for men and women, that sticks around no matter what.
So the court's message was, tough luck, Brown. Find a way.
That's a good way to put it. And they really emphasize that if a school is making cuts to athletic programs, those cuts cannot unfairly target women. That's a big no-no under Title IX. And remember, in Brown's case, they specifically cut women's teams when there was already a huge gap in participation between men and women. So that just didn't fly.
Again, we see the court looking beyond just the letter of the law and really considering the overall impact of Brown's actions.
Right. They were focused on the big picture, and they were really trying to uphold the spirit of Title IX and the intent behind it.
It's like they were saying, we get it, Brown, you're facing some challenges, but you still have to follow the law and you have to do it in a way that actually promotes gender equity.
Absolutely. They made it very clear that equal opportunity for women in athletics isn't just some optional thing. It's a core part of the law, and schools have to take it seriously.
So what does all of this mean for college athletes today, decades after this whole Cohen v. Brown saga unfolded? What's the lasting legacy of this case?
Well, I think it really put schools on notice. It said, hey, you can't ignore these issues anymore. Gender equity matters. And Cohen v. Brown created a roadmap for athletes who feel like they're being treated unfairly. It gave them a way to fight back.
It's like they have a legal playbook now.
Exactly. And that's why it's still so relevant today. It's a reminder that the fight for equality in college sports is far from over. And it shows that the courts can be a really powerful force for creating positive change.
This has been a fascinating deep dive so far. We've talked about Title IX, the three-pronged test, Brown's attempt to use the budget as a defense, and even this idea of competitive opportunities. Mm. But there's one more piece to this puzzle, something we haven't really explored yet.
And it's a big one. This final point will really bring everything full circle and highlight some of the ongoing challenges and debates surrounding Title IX.
Okay, you've got me intrigued. Listeners, stay tuned. We're about to head into the final stretch of our deep dives into Cohen v. Brown. Okay, so we've talked about how Brown was found liable for violating Title IX, and we've talked about how the appeals court wanted a more nuanced approach to those remedies, something that went beyond just checking boxes.
Right, right. And this is where things get tricky, because throughout this whole legal battle, there was this kind of elephant in the room, this underlying issue that no one was really addressing directly.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What was this elephant?
Well, it's this whole emphasis on proportionality as the primary measure of Title IX compliance. Remember that first prong of the three-part test, substantial proportionality.
Yeah, matching the percentage of female athletes to the percentage of female students.
Exactly. And while that number is definitely important, it's not the whole story. And focusing so heavily on proportionality, well, it's had some unintended consequences, and it's created a lot of debate.
Like what kind of consequences? What are we talking about here?
So some people argue that it's made schools focus too much on just hitting that numerical target instead of actually addressing the root causes of gender inequity in athletics. Like, some schools might just add more female athletes to their rosters just to make the numbers look good.
But not really caring about whether those athletes are actually getting meaningful opportunities.
Exactly. And that brings us back to that idea of competitive opportunities that we talked about earlier. Just having a bunch of women on a team doesn't mean they're getting a comparable experience to male athletes.
So proportionality, it might give you a snapshot, but it doesn't tell you the whole story.
Right. And this is a debate that's still going on today. Some people say proportionality is absolutely crucial, that it's the most objective way to measure progress. Others say it's too simplistic, that it can actually hide some deeper issues.
It seems like a complex issue with valid points on both sides.
It really is, and it gets even more complicated when you factor in things like emerging sports and shifting demographics, the fact that the world of college athletics is constantly changing.
So where does all of this leave us? What's the takeaway for our listeners who are thinking about this case and its impact?
I think Cohen v. Brown teaches us a few valuable lessons, even all these years later. It reminds us that true gender equality in college sports, it's a complex process. It's not something that happens overnight.
It's not about just checking boxes or meeting a quota.
It's about creating a culture that's truly inclusive and equitable, where all athletes have a genuine opportunity to succeed and reach their full potential. And it's about being willing to have those tough conversations and challenge the status quo.
We can't just assume everything's fine because we hit some arbitrary number.
Exactly. Cohen v. Brown was a major victory, a landmark case, no doubt about it. But it wasn't the end of the story. The fight for gender equality in athletics, that's an ongoing thing. It's up to all of us to keep pushing for progress and make sure that everyone has a fair shot.
This deep dive into Cohen v. Brown has been amazing. I feel like we've really gotten into the weeds of this case.
Yeah.
Learn about Title Nikes, the three-prong test, Brown's budget arguments, this whole debate about proportionality. It's been a really rich discussion.
It really has. It just shows you how these big legal battles, they can have ripple effects that last for decades, and they force us to keep thinking about these issues and how to create a more just and equitable world.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Cohen v. Brown. We hope you learned a lot, maybe got a little inspired to keep fighting for equality in your own way. Until next time on The Deep Dive.